From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. E. Maury Atkinson from Cook Pharmica is interviewed by Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling on what biomanufacturers need to know about subvisible particles in biotechnology drugs.
Dr. E. Maury Atkinson is Vice President of R&D and Chief Scientific Officer at Cook Pharmica, a biopharmaceutical contract development and manufacturing organization. Dr. Atkinson is a process development specialist with expertise in gene therapy, vaccines, recombinant proteins, and monoclonal antibodies. Dr. Atkinson, what are subvisible particles, and why should pharma and biotech manufacturers be concerned?
Subvisible particles are actually particles that are, as the name implies, invisible to the human eye. Typically, these are particles are less than 10 micron in size. And so, you know, conventional particle analysis and visual inspection can usually detect particles that are larger than 10 microns. And so the subvisibles fall into that lower range. One of the concerns is that the USP actually doesn't address particles of this size at all. And so it's something that has not really been assessed in pharmaceutical products. But in 2009, John Carpenter, who's an academic researcher and a team of researchers, which included FDA scientists, actually published an article in the Journal of Pharmaceutical Sciences that talked about subvisible particles, and the title is Overlooking Subvisible Particles in Therapeutic Protein Products, Gaps That May Compromise Product Quality. And some very influential people in the FDA were on this paper as well. So it really brought attention to the fact that subvisible particles may be present in pharmaceutical formulations but have not really been assessed prior to this.
One of the things I discovered reading about this topic was this whole business of immunogenicity. Would you discuss the evidence that exists, either in animal or human studies, that protein aggregates under 10 micrometers can present immunogenicity problems?
Well, the problem is there's no really definitive evidence that subvisible particles as a class actually are immunogenic. And it's a broad topic because subvisible particles can be made up of proteins, which is obviously one of the primary concerns, but they could also be made up of extrinsic substances like silicone oil, or even air bubbles can show up as subvisible particles in measurements. And so the concern really stems from the fact that there's a wide held belief that larger protein aggregates are immunogenic, and then that subvisible particles may represent those large protein aggregates, and therefore subvisible particles may represent a class of immunogenic forms in pharmaceutical products. And so there's no direct data, and so the FDA is concerned about it. And when there's no data and there's concern, then the desire is to actually gather more data and try to correlate the presence of subvisible particles with any adverse events or immunogenicity that the agency might be seeing during development and post-marketing monitoring for these products.
Would you talk about the top five issues that drug manufacturers should know about subvisible particles?
First of all, everyone needs to know that the agency is concerned about this. And I think for people who have not been paying close attention to regulatory trends, they might have missed the fact that this has emerged relatively recently, really in the last 2 years, as a concern for the agency. And therefore, the sponsors of applications need to know how to address the concerns, because if the FDA is concerned, obviously the developers are as well. And since I mentioned the risks aren't really known, there's more information is going to have to be generated to help assess this risk. And that's going to fall back to people developing parenteral drugs to generate that information, because the agency simply can't do that type of research on its own, and even the academic labs can't. So that will come back on the industry to be able to help provide the information. And there are techniques available. So, you know, number four is you can measure these, but most of these techniques aren't really ready for quality control laboratories. So they're more investigational or characterization type techniques. So even setting limits, specifications, or targets is difficult to contemplate when you're thinking about measuring it. So it's still in the realm of almost a research type approach. And in order to know the relative risk, finally, of these particles, you're going to have to know what you have, the type of particle you have, as well as the quantity. Because in some cases, you know, you're talking about a very small mass ratio of the material that's actually in subvisible particles, or it may be things like silicone oil, dust, or air bubbles. And so it's going to take a bit more than a simple measurement to be able to address the issue. And my concern has been, as sponsors are developing their drugs, if they're not aware of this and get asked for this information, many people might not even know where to go to find this out.
Now, you mentioned that paper in 2009, which really brought attention to this whole area of subvisible particles. Just what is the biotech pharma industry's perspective on subvisible particles?
Well, about a year later, there's actually a paper that was published again in Journal of Pharmaceutical Sciences called An Industry Perspective on the Monitoring. And so in this case, a group of people from industry put their heads together and talked about exactly what I'm saying, which is that these are difficult to measure. And there's no direct link between clinical immunogenicity and subvisible particles. And so it really the risk is relatively low. And there's also a belief that since the material has been in clinical trials, that the risk has really already been assessed. So even if you haven't measured subvisible particles in your formulations, you have by definition assessed the risk by your clinical development as well as any monitoring that you might do post-launch. So relatively low risk, that the techniques are not well established, and that the risk has already been at least somewhat assessed by trials. But obviously, these conversations have been ongoing then subsequently, and there have been various meetings and fora where both the agency and industry and academic researchers have met and discussed this topic a number of times. So it's clearly still an emerging perspective, but the industry at least has published at least one paper specifically stating a position of the people on that paper.
What types of recommendations have come from the FDA relating to subvisible particles?
Well, they're asking for at least data to be shared with them during a sponsor's application. You know, most people don't know directly what the agency has asked each sponsor for in their application, but I'm aware of requests that have come from the FDA on at least providing information on subvisible particles in the parenteral formulations. And, you know, the understanding is they're using this information to try to correlate with any adverse event data that they're collecting along with those applications. So they're trying to make some internal risk assessment. So they're asking people to measure it and provide the data. But they've not issued specific guidance or regulatory positions on subvisible particles other than doing it, I think, in an ad hoc basis. But publicly at conferences are talking about it and joining in the conversation. So, but no specific guideline that I'm aware of has come from them.
Which analytical tools are used to measure protein aggregates and subvisible visible particles?
Well, routinely, at the low end of the particle range, when you're looking at dimers, trimers, and multimers, routinely size exclusion chromatography is used and is quite good for looking at those particular types of particles. And on the high end, we have, as I mentioned before, HIAC light obscuration measurements, which is accepted for particle measurement as well as visual observation. But in between those is where we're more limited to techniques that are more, you know, really characterization techniques and more suitable for R&D and not typically used for routine lot release. So on the low end, we have analytical ultracentrifugation and field flow fractionation, which can look at very small particles, really less than a micron. When you're in that mid-range, though, which is the primary concern of the current discussion around subvisible particles, you really have two options. There's a microflow imaging system that uses a microscope, and it actually measures the number of particles but also visualizes them so you can see if they're spheres or protein blobs, irregularly shaped aggregates of proteins. And then in addition, there's a technique called a nanoparticle tracking analysis, which uses the Brownian motion of particles and light to quantitate and visualize the particles. But really, neither of those techniques is currently suitable for the type of analysis one might do in a quality control unit where you would do it for routine lot release and testing. So we're limited, but there are some techniques available. And part of this original publication was to call for additional development of analytical techniques that can really measure things in this size range.
How might a CMO help drug companies address questions surrounding subvisible particles?
Well, especially for sponsors that would be new to this and small companies wouldn't necessarily want to spend the capital to buy the type of equipment needed. So for CMOs, we see a number of clients with parenteral formulations and different formulations, different container closures, and different proteins that have different tendencies to aggregate. So with this capability, we can help assess that fairly easily and routinely, whereas someone who's not done a whole lot of biophysical analysis of their material may not want to invest in this capability to do some fairly limited measurements. You're not going to do a lot of research around this, especially early in drug development.
Let's talk a little bit more about Cook Pharmica's expertise and capabilities in working with companies who need assistance with this issue of sub-visible particles. Talk about that expertise and what kind of capabilities and abilities and instruments do you bring to bear to people who come to you with problems or concerns in this area?
Well, we're primarily using microflow imaging, finding it to be probably the most versatile for this particular purpose. But because we do both syringe and vial filling and liquid and lyophilized products, it really behooves us to be able to field this capability for our clients. We use large-scale time pressure filling system on a fairly fast line on the syringe and vial lines. So our clients are going to be asked this question. We know this, and we feel like we have to provide this capability. So our formulation lab has actually implemented this, and we've also done quite a few studies ourselves, creating particles in different ways by, you know, different formulations, different proteins, and different conditions to try to visualize and characterize the type of particles that we're seeing in order to have maybe a baseline background that we can go back and compare to if our clients have this concern or ask this question. So we felt like it was a preemptive thing that we needed to put in place in order to help people develop. Our syringe line is fairly new, as well as our vial line, and we were excited to be able to bring this up in parallel with our new lines to be able to help our clients with this particular issue, as well as others. I mean, we have biophysical capability to look at many things. We have dynamic light scattering and other techniques that we can help even non-drug product, but drug substance or intermediate particle characterization. So we're trying to provide really a whole range of options for the clients working on injectables.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.